Well, hello and welcome to another episode of The Capitol Record, brought to you by National Review. And I am your host, David Bahnsen, coming each and every week with the goal of defending the cause of a free and virtuous society. And I am very privileged to today bring back to Capitol Record for the second time the guest that perhaps has had more to do with inspiring Capitol Record than any other guest. He is my mentor, friend, and economic hero in defense of this free and virtuous society of which we speak. That is Father Robert Sirico, the co-founder and chairman emeritus at the Acton Institute. Father, welcome back to Capitol Record.
Great to be with you again. Thank you, David. I always enjoy our conversations.
And of course, our conversations are prone to be able to go all over the place. There's so many topics of shared interest and passion, and particularly in this subject of defending free enterprise and defending the, in particular on this podcast, we like to dive deep into why capital markets are worthy of our defense. And, you know, you're kind of the, what is it, the Bill Parcells coaching tree of the of Capitol Record, because while I've enjoyed our time, I've also been able to have on Sam Gregg and Jay Richards and Anthony Bradley and Jordan Baylor and a lot of others affiliated with the Institute. Hunter Baker's been on a couple times. Yes. So, you know, there's a remnant of us, both in the Catholic tradition and Protestant tradition, that are out fighting this cause, but I still will give you the credit over the last 30 years, particularly in intellectual thought, of defending this great spiritual priority.
It just makes sense to me. You know, I'm not an academic like Sam Gregg is or these other guys you mentioned, but I just kind of saw it as a whole. And for me, theologically, it's rooted in the incarnation, the seriousness with which God takes his creation so that he redeems his creation from the midst of his creation. It works for me. It takes a lot of work to, you know, make the economic connections, but I think they're all there.
Well, I certainly agree, and I think that the one of the reasons that it's timely for us to kind of revisit here on the podcast is your brand new book that Regnery has just published, and that I am really honored to be on the back cover of, giving it the commendation it deserves. But the name of the book is The Economics of the Parables, and so when you talk about these incarnational truths that you believe in and inspired by and serve as sort of the fodder to the development of your think tank over the last 30 plus years. Are the parables something that sort of inspired you as providing some economic truth and lesson more recently, or have you always thought that there was some unpacking to be done specifically in the parables of Jesus?
Well, I suppose there's unpacking to be done. The whole, what should I call it, methodology of the parables is so in sync with everything else with regard to the scriptures, with regard to the incarnation, in that our Lord begins with what is most obvious and proximate to us, our world, the world of scarcity, the material world. And then he launches from that an indicator of what is beyond this world. So now, as a preacher, you know, I've been preaching on the parables for all these decades, and in my own mind would see these connections. So that was in the back of my mind for a long time. And I kept my sermons, my homilies over the years, and then finally was able to consult the large body of work on the parables. Interestingly enough, while there are essays that talk about economic dimensions of the parables, there's very little substantial literature on the parables. I think this isn't substantial, but it's a beginning. a way in?
Well, it hit me when I was reading your book that oftentimes the passages I've read from Jesus' earthly ministry that deal with economics are what I would call defensive writings. It's people who have a pro-market view that are taking the rich young ruler passage and feeling the need to go defend it, to go explain what it doesn't mean and doesn't say. And one of the first books that I read, I was actually introduced to at an Acton event, but this gentleman wasn't affiliated with Acton. And it was our old friend, John Schneider, wrote a book called The Good of Affluence.
Right.
And he attempted to do something exegetical. He went through creation, which many of the Acton fellows have done, but also went through the Old Testament prophets and then Jesus' writing, mostly dealing with these defensive passages and then the Pauline epistles to make kind of an exegetical case for the goodness of markets and whatnot. You seem to be doing something more proactive here with the parables. Maybe you could walk through kind of what your intent was.
Yeah, I think what I'm trying to just read the parables and then see what economic dimensions and the 13 that I chose, and that doesn't exhaust the list. The 13 that I chose are just the most obvious. And it seems to me that there's an assumption, and it's not an assumption about economics in the mind of the first century. It's an assumption about human life, and that Jesus is just talking about human life and interaction, not public policy, not mathematics, not economics proper, you know, in what has come to be known as economics. All of that develops later, and I try to be very careful not to eisegete these parables, because I don't like it when I see the left do it. We've talked before about the mistake that one can make on either side, either the prosperity gospel or liberation theology side. And I didn't want to do that. I just want to say, what do we have here when you talk about a field that needs to be harvested, or when you talk about an inheritance dispute between two sons, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. What do we have here? And how would we describe that in economic language? And there, as you see, there are a lot of insights that are going on in these stories, these simple little enduring stories.
Did you have, as you were writing this, a particular favorite that was most inspiring or most profound, maybe even most surprising in the kind of richness of its not just the storytelling, but even the specifically economic takeaways?
Well, when you ask favorite, you know, which is your favorite child, right?
Yeah, see, I've always thought that isn't as hard of a trick question as people think, because depending on the day, I usually have an answer. You know?
Oh, well, that's good. Okay, so today, what's my favorite parable? Well, I mean, there are a number of insights. The pearl of great price, am I right? That's the shortest. It's one sentence.
Yeah.
What's interesting about that and striking is I thought about it, is that Jesus is employing the imagery of a luxury good here, which is the thing that most people on the left are the first to condemn. It has no utility other than its beauty. And yet the one who finds it is willing to sacrifice everything. And what's that? There's a hymn, I forget the name of the hymn, about casting down our golden crowns, you know, that whole image of divesting ourselves of everything, even our worthy achievements, in order to attain this one thing that is so precious. And the insight that it took on the part of that merchant to discover it was an object that was not formed by manufacturing, but formed by nature. In those days, there were no artificial pearls. So, there are a lot of, nuances to that that I found intriguing.
Well, and I think the point that you make of that, and you made reference to this earlier, some of the things Jesus said, he's able to take for granted. Like there's a lot of, there's something we can learn from what he was even assuming, let alone what he was saying. And I think your point about there being a cost, if we don't assume there is a cost in a transaction, right. Then this analogy to the kind of sacrifice of getting into heaven, of being obedient, of living the Christian right. life, the analogy wouldn't make sense apart from that sort of presupposed understanding of cost. And in a way, I guess you could say Jesus said there was no free lunch before Milton Friedman ever said it.
No, exactly that. And I think, you know, Milton Friedman was drawing from reality, that he just saw what was in front of him. The other thing that comes up in this, in a similar mode, is the notion of risk that's involved. In the parable of the talents, what gets the one guy who doesn't produce in trouble is that he's afraid. Mm-hmm. He allows his fear, which is a misperception of the benefactor, to paralyze him. And so he doesn't do anything with the money. He doesn't lose the money. It's interesting too, right? It's not like he's given one talent and he gives him back a half a talent. No, he's given one talent, he gives him back a talent. It's that he misperceived the benefactor and was afraid and was not willing to take the risk, which the others in the parable that I'm using, the version of the parable I'm using, the other two do. They're willing to risk. And what would be interesting for our meditation, this is, by the way, one of the reasons that parables have such enduring power, is that they're somewhat, or at least many of them, are very vague. And, you know, you can think around in them. And in this one, I'm suggesting, wouldn't it be interesting to imagine that the master comes back and the two who multiply their talents actually lose? What does that say about people who lose in a market, who are not morally culpable? It's not the case that every time you fail in the market that you're morally culpable for it. Maybe you had to do a little more due diligence, but sometimes markets just change.
Yeah, I wonder where that came from. Is there a church history tradition that would have provided a moral stigma to someone who miscalculated in economic calculation? Would that be something in the tradition of Aquinas that we could find?
Nothing comes to my mind. I mean, there's the passage, there's the parable of the house being built on sand. So that's a miscalculation, or the one with the tower, the building of the tower, and then the barns. You know, I'm going to take everything and put them in my barns. Those are miscalculations, but I'm not saying that.
Although I think even there, some of those would be more non-calculations than miscalculations, right? Like the tower, failure to count the cost.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly a miscalculation to think if you build your house on sand.
Yeah, right.
That it's going to be.
Although I guess maybe there the it would be a kind of clearly avoidable miscalculation, like. As opposed to the kind of nuance of you tried to calculate, it appeared to be wise at the time, and circumstances changed, where I would imagine the presumption in building on sand was you should have known sand was a bad foundation to begin with.
Yeah, I might have had a better view.
Yeah, right. But whereas in
people in Malibu.
in current times, I think the point you bring up is a really important one. Not demonizing risk-taking implies that when risk-taking goes against us, that we not assume a moral failing, because in fact, I would argue so much of the productive side of markets and the kind of human toll can be really quite profitable. when the lessons learned and character formation and things like that.
Yeah, I think that's very much the case.
So in terms of writing the book, and obviously you've done an incredible amount of work over the years when we talk about the anthropology of economics, the creation account and work from Genesis has gotten so much attention in our efforts to truly formulate a Christian foundation to liberty, to economics, to ordered liberty, to kind of branch outside of the creation account and go into these parables. It kind of required a reminder as to why the parables themselves, even apart from the economic dimension that you're exploring, is so important. That was one of the things I really benefited from in your book, was a kind of restoration of appreciation for the parables themselves. Maybe you could talk a little bit about why storytelling is so important theologically.
Well, I can reflect on that theologically, but let me first say pastorally. What I found is, you know, I've preached on these and other parables many, many years, and what's has always struck me is after a mass, when people are coming out the door, to have a reflection. I'm not just talking about, oh, that was a wonderful sermon, Father, thank you very much, but to really have a thoughtful word or two from a child, which is always the highest compliment when a kid tells you, and I always ask them, well, what was it about it? And they'll tell me something substantive. But at the same homily, in the same mass, to have an economist or a lawyer or a doctor also reflect on something that they got out of it. And I think that's accomplished by this parabolic way of speaking, that when you draw these ambiguities, what I called earlier ambiguities, and you know it's not didactic, and you're telling a story, there's a lot in those stories that people pick up from various angles, as a child or as an adult and everything in between. I've been describing it as watching the Muppets with my niece and nephew. These are the old Muppets when they were good.
Yeah.
And laughing uproariously together at different things. You know, and this is what's going on, I think, I guess that's a theological insight as well as a pastoral insight, right? Because that's, Jesus says, let him that has ears hear. Now, he says that for a particular reason, because he's got, you know, people eavesdropping on him, looking to take him out. But he still has to preach this message to those who are receptive.
Well, I think you had mentioned earlier in the conversation that there's a sense in which Jesus talking with these parables, you know, there's such an advantage to being able to take for granted that there is wisdom in Jesus teaching for all aspects of our life. And that wherever the need to compartmentalize these things and sort of dualistically assume that there's, you know, either sacred or actual, you know, worldly significance in certain things, I guess there was a kind of presumption of broad application of Jesus teaching into all of these different dimensions of the human person's life.
What's the quote from Kuiper that Chuck Colson was fond of citing?
Every square inch.
Every square inch is mine.
Yeah.
Because its origin is in him.
Yeah.
And so why wouldn't a good Jew teach in this way?
Well, I would hope that a lot of the readers of the book will be people who maybe have always had spiritual or pastoral appreciation for parables, and yet will find a whole new door opened into another square inch of the efficacy of these parables in the economic dimension. The one that I wanted to unpack with you a little bit, given the day and age, the most common opposition that we find in religious circles to a pro-market economy view, whether it be in Catholic or evangelical circles, is some form of social justice that would pit the accumulation of wealth and the advancement of material prosperity against the underprivileged, against the poor, against the oppressed. And when you talk about the Good Samaritan, it seems to me there is some wisdom in a more holistic understanding of charity in this parable than we are led to believe.
When you say holistic, I want to underscore that 10 times. Yeah. A holistic understanding, which, by the way, has a certain echo of the incarnation, right? This is the whole thing. And it is not just, as our friend Marvin Olasky used to point out, that compassion is not giving to, it's suffering with. Yeah. And the Samaritan here suffers with this man. He has the unpleasant task that he takes upon himself of cleaning his wounds, and he does it with his own medicinal supply, right? His own wine or an oil. He's cleaning this man, and then he hoists him up on his beast, it says, and so it's his physical intimate contact with this man's broken body and putting him on his own means of transportation, taking him in to the innkeeper, and then in effect putting himself in hock because you take care of him, and then if you spend any more, I'll pay you on the way back. I mean, this is all personal. This is intimate. This is holistic. It's not administrative. It's not as important as it is to, you know, have a division of labor. It's not that for the most part. It's very personal. And who gets enriched by this? Well, certainly the man whose body is broken, but I think also the Samaritan sees himself ennobled by it. And probably the bystander, the innkeeper, is edified by the example of this.
It seems to me that there's a conviction here that is not merely directed at the left. That when we rightly critique their view as being materialistic, as being short-sighted, as not understanding how wealth is really created and how poverty is really cured, I think the point that people like yourself and Arthur Brooks and many in more recent times have made on this score are very, very important. And that the kind of traditional right-wing view of teach a man to fish and all these, you know, platitudes, I think all those things are right in a point, but it seems that you're saying something that offers more conviction to our side, which is that, okay, that's great that you believe in wealth creation, productivity, honoring the dignity of the person, creating a greater wealth pie that will enable more opportunity for philanthropy, but on an individual basis, you have an obligation to suffer with your suffering, yes, brother, to be in their lives, in their wounds, to play off of that metaphor. I hope that there will be some effort for those of us who already agree with the economic message to extract the deeper spiritual message.
Yeah, I think that's really essential, and part of that comes from the anthropology, the recognition that this is a person whose worth exceeds his material existence. But, you know, you know who Dorothy Day was, the founder of the Catholic Worker. One of her associates was Peter Morin, and this really shows how these kinds of matters can transcend the political divides. Now, they were identified with the left, particularly Dorothy Day, because she had been a member of the Communist Party and then had her conversion to Christianity. But one of the most ruthless takedowns of the welfare state that I have ever read was in the writings of this Peter Morin. And it's precisely for the reasons that I'm saying, is not that it's too generous, but that it's too cheap. It doesn't meet the whole need of the person, and it deprives us of the privilege to serve Christ in these distressing disguises. So I think there's a way in which these things can transcend the left and the right. And boy, don't we need that now more than ever before? I mean, I happen to like, as you know, the banter back and forth, the disagreement of people without it becoming disagreeable. And there's so little of that across these divides right now. It's immediately people go to name calling and to talking points. And I find that fatiguing. You know, it's reminiscent of Bonhoeffer, who I just came upon this passage. Actually, it's several letters. Bonhoeffer talks about being stupid. Do you know his whole thing on stupidity?
No.
This, you know, you could put this as a meme under a number of these. You know, these protests, like the Jordan, the people who are protesting Jordan, and they just yell in your face. You've probably had it too. I mean, I've had it where people just yell in your face. He says, and I'm quoting here, "Stupidity is a more dangerous enemy of the good than malice. One may protest against evil. It can be exposed and, if need be, prevented by use of force. Evil always carries within itself the germ of its own subversion, in that it leaves behind in human beings at least a sense of unease. Against stupidity, we are defenseless." You know, because, you know, it's not protest, it's not the use of reason, it's not argument that can penetrate stupidity. And he identifies the defect of stupidity as being essentially a moral defect. It's not an intellectual defect.
Well, and this, by the way, is, you know, the legacy of the late Greg Bahnsen, that most intellectual defects were, in fact, moral and spiritual defects, particularly applied in the antithesis to the unbelief of man, that it was our attempts to solve these things intellectually rather than what they are as intrinsically spiritual and moral and in the ethical dimension is futile.
Yes, another holistic view of reality.
Well, I wonder then if there isn't enough controversy in our shared appreciation of the parables, if we could talk a second on Bonhoeffer's point there. Is he, in a way, presciently talking about right-wing populism in 2022?
I think it's as applicable to right-wing populism, integralism, as it is to the transgender thing. You know, when I look at those audiences as ideologically opposed to one another as they are, I get the same smell. Yeah. I get the same sense of irrationality, of people who don't want to just sit and kind of break down the argument. So, yeah, I think it applies to the moment, not just to any one or another of the movements.
I think that there is wisdom in his point, certainly from our vantage point as adherents of a particular market orthodoxy or a biblical worldview on liberty, that stupidity is tougher to argue with because...
No argument.
I think that Lenin made, and Marx for that matter, laid out the presuppositions that were intrinsically and inherently evil in their worldview. They laid it out in chapter one and allowed a critique of the Marxist-Leninist view to be fully focused on where they were wrong about the nature of man. Yeah. I think right now, sometimes you don't really know what you're arguing against because it's an emotion, and this is true in the left wing, the kind of AOC camp, if you will, and definitely with some of these integralist debates, I'm not sure that there's an intellectually coherent view to critique. And I don't say that as a roundabout kind of backdoor way of getting a jab in, a straw man or an ad hominem. I'm not doing that. I think stupidity is the charitable term when one is just clearly, and Twitter and cable news and whatnot, they kind of facilitate it.
They do. You know, the shortness of the dart that you can throw. You know, I'll give this to Marx and that in the development of their epistemology, the Marxian epistemology, they set the seeds right there that this has to be ad hominem. It can't be logic. It has to be based on your class. Uh-huh. And not on your reasons. And that's where you have the absurdity of people saying, well, 2 + 2 can equal 5 under certain circumstances, or the whole notion of this modern math. And you know, it just kind of goes across the board. Whatever rips down the law of identity is lethal. And you can give it a pretense like Marx does, but it becomes lethal and incoherent.
Yeah. Well, I think that we'll have a lot of work to do to overcome the evil of varying competing views out there. But unfortunately, it seems to me we face a couple decades of having to couple our fight against evil with a fight against stupidity.
Yeah. No, I think that's the work we have ahead of us.
And unfortunately, there's a lot of emotional appeal sometimes behind stupidity. Like, if stupidity was equivalent to just self-effacing, clearly, you know, kind of incoherent, like, I don't know, I guess I shouldn't say that, because a lot of the transgenderism seems to me it would be that way, and maybe for some it just isn't. But it strikes me that we believe in free exchange unless we don't. And we believe that in limited government, unless the government's doing something that will help us, it seems to me that there's a clarity of stupidity there that would be entirely unpersuasive that no longer is.
Well, and it doesn't have to be persuasive. That's the whole point of it. You don't have to persuade. All you have to do is intimidate and shout down.
Yeah. Well, I am of good cheer. As you know, I happen to possess this thing rare in the Catholic circles from which you come, called a postmillennial eschatology. Yes. That brings me optimism that will prevail. But of course, I also have...
There's always purgatory, you know.
Yes. So everybody has a fallback, right?
Right.
But even us post-mills, we have the cop-out of saying if we take another setback, we can just claim we got another 1,000 years on our side. So.
There you go.
Father, thank you for writing this book. Thank you in a time of stupidity, in a time of a lot of economic and moral and philosophical ambiguity. Thank you for some theological clarity and spiritual nourishment. Your work here is deeply appreciated.
David, thank you for embodying all these ideas. I mean, you in a unique way bring them together in one person. You're what I'm talking about. You should pardon the expression. You're the John Galt.
Well, I appreciate what you mean and know what you don't mean.
Right, exactly. Thank you.
Yeah. Well, thank you, Father Sirico, and thank all of you for listening once again to Capitol Record. Please find Father Sirico's book, The Economics of the Parables, available Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all the normal places. I will do one last, since this is going to air a few weeks before the greatest event of economic instruction that takes place in any given calendar year, the annual Acton University, recongregating in person this year in Grand Rapids, Michigan, June 20th through the 23rd. Go to acton.org for more info. Both Father and I will be speaking at the event, and joined by many, many hundreds of our closest friends who are themselves students of a free and virtuous society. We'd love for you to learn more about Acton University. And I'd love for you to keep listening to, sharing with all your loved ones, the Capitol Record as we continue in our defense of free enterprise and capital markets. Thank you again for listening to Capitol Record.